Welcome to Securing America with me, Frank Gaffney, the program that's a kind of owner's manual for protecting the country we love against all enemies, foreign and domestic, to the glory of God and that of his kingdom. China, of course, is often top of mind for us when we talk about protecting this country. And there are a few people better equipped to discuss what is going on with China across a broad front than our first guest. His name is Colonel John Mills, United States Army retired. In addition to a very distinguished decades-long service to our country in the uniform of the United States Army and special operations, he has also served at senior levels in the Office of the Secretary of Defense, including directing the office involved in cybersecurity strategy and international affairs. He is a remarkable resource. We have had him, I'm very pleased to say, on this program many times. He's a senior fellow of our Center for Security Policy, as well as one of the co-authors of our new book, The CCP is at War with America, which you can get for free as a downloadable PDF at ccpatwar.com. Among other things, he is the author of another book entitled The Nation Will Follow, about his own personal experiences, among other things, with, well, some serious malfeasance within the United States government and what he has done to try to hold those accountable for it. We're delighted always to have John with us. Thank you, sir. Good day to you and welcome back to Securing America.
Thank you, Frank. Always an honor to be with you.
Thank you. John, you have called to my attention and that of others working in our battle space on China, a very strategically ominous development. Not entirely a surprise, given what the Chinese have been doing in the South Pacific of late, but one that has, well, considerable import for, among other things, our defense of our interests there, notably with respect to Taiwan. Read us in on this development and give us a sense of how we got to this point.
Yes, Frank. It's a very disturbing series of, oftentimes on the American part, missteps and unforced errors. The Prime Minister of the Solomon Islands, the same Solomon Islands, sacred battleground of Guadalcanal, where my own grandfather fought, there's a prime minister there, Manasa Sogavare, who is not very popular, and he's in the minority, and a lot of Solomon Islanders do not like the Chinese who he has let in through essentially being bought off. Now, just a couple of days ago, this is what has evolved from them, and this is an important inflection point. And if the administration fumbles this one too, we are in a de facto state of conflict with the CCP. An American Coast Guard cutter already had a pre-scheduled, pre-arranged port call in the Solomon Islands, and they were essentially ignored. They weren't denied, but they were ignored, which is a de facto denial. They essentially shifted and went to Papua New Guinea. This is essentially the prime minister who is bought off in the Solomons, essentially shutting down and denying access that we had regularly for decades on Coast Guard, merchant vessels, Navy ships with the sacred Solomon Islands. This is game on. And by with the map that we'll be showing during this segment, they've essentially turned our left flank. Think of Gettysburg, where the Confederates tried to turn our left flank, Little Round Top. That's essentially what's happened here, because now they are behind the second island chain, and the bottom south to north is Palau, Ulithi. Then you hit American territory, Guam, Tinian, and Saipan. The Chinese have turned our left flank in the Pacific. We don't have an ambassador. We only had one third of an ambassador because we had an ambassador that shared Vanuatu, Papua New Guinea, and the Solomon Islands. That person who was so important, they were transferred to be in the bowels of USAID. Well, the Chinese are running amok in the Solomon Islands. We don't have an ambassador.
John, you've put a lot on the table here. Let's parse some of this a little bit. When you say the prime minister of the Solomon Islands, who is not very popular, let the Chinese in. What exactly did he do? What kind of presence, what kind of power projection capabilities do the Chinese now have as a result of this arrangement with an apparently corrupt and, as you say, unpopular prime minister?
Well, there's been civil unrest since last fall in the Solomon Islands. Now, Australia came in to help in a peacekeeping operation. Unfortunately, all they did was essentially reinforce the position and status of this unpopular prime minister. The significant majority of the population lives on some of the outer islands from what we would call historically Guadalcanal. They live on Tulagi and other islands. They are the majority. They don't like this prime minister. He has effectively been bought off in a belt and road operation. It's unclear because of the lack of transparency, but essentially now there is de facto basing rights for the PLA Navy. And effectively, he just shut down. And they did not deny. They just did not respond. There's a communication that has to take place. We were turned away.
John, as I understand it, that in part in response to the hash-up of the Australians, the Chinese were also able to insert police trainers and the like on the ground. So it's not just, you know, port visits for the Chinese that are no longer now being apparently extended to us, but it's also they have a presence there and they're training and presumably they are helping to prop up a guy that sounds like he's more and more a puppet. The Belt and Road Initiative, of course, is something we talk about regularly on this program, John, and it really speaks to this question of the Chinese colonial build-out, really, of their presence around the world, including in strategically critical places like the Solomon Islands. Talk a little bit about the kind of power projection options that would be available to them as a result of this presence there.
Yeah, and as you stated, this was a replay of Hong Kong where the CCP inserted their police and relieved and fired and removed the traditional Hong Kong police who were not being rough enough with the Hong Kongers. This is a replay of that game. So now with essentially a footprint of various states and various purposes in the Solomons, they're now behind the all-important Second Island chain. U.S. Indo-Pacific Command is working on basing agreements and other agreements with the Republic of Palau from the Second World War. We would know that. Then moving up Ulithi, which is part of the Federated States of Micronesia. They are pro-CCP. Bad situation. Ulithi is the gathering point for the largest fleet in world history, the combined American-British fleets for the final push on Japan in World War II. Important base opportunity there. We haven't closed the deal, and it's unclear where we're at with them and Palau, which is more pro-Taiwan. And then you hit American territory.
John, I want to pause for just a second here. We have to take a short break. This is all, I think, framed up in the map we're showing here. This first island chain is critical to our defense of Taiwan and our ability to contain the Chinese if we have the wherewithal to do that. And the second island chain essentially can destroy the hold that we would have on that first island chain. We're going to talk more about this and most especially with one of the smartest guys I know on these sorts of questions. What should we be doing now to reestablish our primacy and security interests in that region? More with Colonel John Mills right after this.
This
is Frank Affney with the Secure Freedom Minute. Whistleblowers have reportedly been confirming to Senators Ron Johnson and Chuck Grassley what many of us have long suspected. The Federal Bureau of Investigations is no longer a premier law enforcement agency whose senior leaders honor their oaths to, quote, support and defend the Constitution of the United States against all enemies, foreign and domestic, unquote. Instead, the acronym FBI these days seems to stand for Friends of Biden, Inc., namely, the crime syndicate that does business as our nation's first family. Thus, we have the spectacle of heavily armed FBI agents rounding up and humiliating the president's political enemies, including raiding the Florida home of his once and likely future rival. Even more odious have been the Bureau's efforts to cover up for or otherwise enable the serial lies, corruption, and betrayals of the big guy, his son, and other relatives and business partners. Enough. This is Frank Affney. We're back. We're visiting with Colonel John Mills, United States Army retired, senior fellow of the Center for Security Policy and member of our Committee on the Present Danger, China. Very valuable resource and resourceful individual indeed. And John, you were just talking a bit about the extent to which even American territory in this second island chain, notably Guam, would be very much impacted by a Chinese military presence in one or more parts of it. I'm interested in both what that would do to, as you say, turn our left flank. And that's a term that, you know, lay people may or may not understand. But talk about the strategic import of it, as well as let's get into what you would recommend we do to try, as I say, to, you know, restore the position we really need there strategically.
Yeah, thank you, Frank. The first island chain is the Republic of Taiwan. North of that, Okinawa, heavy U.S. presence on Japanese territory. Behind Taiwan, immediately the Japanese Senkaku Islands. Japan will defend Taiwan, whether we waffle or not. It'll be war. It'll be a world war. Below that is the Philippines. The second island chain is Palau, Ulithi, Guam, Tinian, Saipan. For China to close the pincers and take Taiwan, they know we need Guam, Tinian, and Saipan to project a fire to support Taiwan. They will take out, that's American territory. China will take out by fire, by force, Guam, Tinian, and Saipan, because they know all of our war plans depend on those critical three islands. And now they're actually behind us by being in Guadalcanal. So very, very precarious situation at this point.
So they're enveloping not only Taiwan, but you're saying that they've essentially put themselves in a position to have a much more concerted assault on these three American essentially bases that we would be projecting power from. This is in addition, of course, to being able to attack them via ballistic missiles or naval forces that would simply be operating from the mainland. And John, you put all this together, this is a momentous thing. You mentioned that, you know, conflict would be that much more likely. And our argument, of course, in our book, The CCP is at War with America, is that they have been for quite some time. But what you're talking about now is moving very much into the kinetic realm as part of their plan, not only for Taiwan, but I think probably for the rest of the world as well. What should America be doing now, if anything can be done, to counter this strategic development of such ominous import?
Well, the administration just pocket vetoed artillery and helicopters to Taiwan. poo-pooing them and essentially moving some of those resources to the Ukraine. They need to overturn that immediately and do whatever it takes to reinforce. We need to provide artillery, missiles in mass to Taiwan. They just had a huge budget increase in Taiwan. They self-paid for it with the incredible revenue they're earning from being the chip maker of the world, which is why China wants Taiwan now. And so we need to reinforce them significantly. We need to bring them into the F-35 program, the AUKUS arrangement. A couple of things Taiwan can do for us. They have this, they could do chips for freedom.
Before we go there, just to dwell on that last point for a moment, John. You talk about some arrangements that we could bring them into. The F-35 is an obvious one. AUKUS refers to an arrangement with Australia, the United Kingdom, and the U.S. to have nuclear submarines built and operated by the Australians with our help and support and that of the Brits. How would a Taiwan engagement in that work, as you said?
Jim Miller, who's leading the AUKUS arrangement, they've rapidly expanded the scope of AUKUS to include hypersonic missiles, long-range fire missiles, cyber, many other matters. It's very likely that Japan will be brought into the AUKUS arrangement. And Japan is very close to Taiwan. We should just bring Taiwan in. But Taiwan can help rebuild our industrial base, and they can set up assembly lines in Taiwan for American missiles as we try to recreate the Arsenal of Democracy 2.0 and build missiles 24/7. And then Taiwan has this incredible PAVPAS radar. It's not well known, but it's unclassified. It's out there. We have these radars defending America. This radar has a deep look capability into China and tells Taiwan many things. They should propose a sharing arrangement with AUKUS, where they share the goodness, and also we share in the defense of that all-important radar, which will probably be the first thing China will try to attack when they go kinetic.
That's a soft target, so it would be hard to defend against, I would imagine. But, John, I guess the question I have is, at a moment when we're looking at supply chain dependencies that are problematic, and not least, I'm told that some 90% or so of the batteries upon which our U.S. military relies are sourced from China, for heaven's sakes. And I don't think this is the only thing that we're relying on them for, even for our national security, let alone our commercial competitiveness. Should we really be looking at putting more of our supply chains, especially given that it will take time to stand them up, in a vulnerable place that China is clearly, as you say, poised to try to seize? And I want to come back to your conversation about the chips manufactured there. But does that make sense, really? I get that we want to ramp up our production capabilities outside of China, of course. But Taiwan, is that really a place we would want to have them?
Well, it's a strategic symbol, if nothing else. And the reality is they can do it. They have shown a capability to produce these materials. A lot of those batteries also come from Taiwan. Taiwan is just blessed with incredible capability. Yes, onshoring back to the United States also is very wise. I was just looking at an onshoring report this morning where there's a latency of effect, but this was all started by President Trump, and everybody since he said it, and companies didn't immediately in a nanosecond move to the U.S. They said, oh, it's a failure. Oh, it's just talk. No, it's actually, look at, 3 years later, the onshoring back to America is building up incredible momentum, and incredible, it is really happening despite what the current administration is doing to destroy the American economy. Onshoring back to America is gathering immense momentum. We need jobs for Americans. Yeah. Good jobs.
For sure. John, we have to wrap it with that. You've laid out some very practical, specific steps, and you know, those chips are a part of that we want to talk with you more about in the near future if we can. Let me just say, for the present purpose, the kind of clarity that you bring to this with respect to the importance of Taiwan and the dangers that are now a building from the Chinese encirclement of that island, both literally in the aftermath of the Pelosi trip, particularly, you know, the no-go zones as they put up for their live fire exercises, but also now this play with the second island chain really requires urgent attention from the administration. I trust that they will be heeding some of that advice, and we will certainly be doing all we can to amplify it. Thank you for your time. Thank you for your terrific new book, The Nation Will Follow. I commend it to all of our listeners. It's available now, as I understand it, for pre-order, and I hope you will go get it. John, come back to us with updates on all of this very soon, if you would. Next up, we'll speak with Bill Marshall of Judicial Watch. We'll talk about Judicial Watch's terrifically important work, trying to get to the bottom, among other things, of the Trump raid by the FBI at Mar-a-Lago. That and much more with Judicial Watch's Bill Marshall right after this.
Black-garbed assailants clash with police in the streets, smash windows, and throw Molotov cocktails in an effort to destroy police stations, federal courthouses, and local businesses, all in the name of anti-fascism. Most Americans are now, sadly, all too aware of the movement known as Antifa. But where did they come from? What do they want? And how do we stop their campaign of violent mayhem? The Center for Security Policy Press is proud to present Unmasking Antifa, Five Perspectives on a Growing Threat. This new book looks at the history, ideology, organization, finances, and strategy of Antifa and provides an in-depth analysis for law enforcement officers, policymakers, and the general public. From street fighting tactics of the Black Bloc to fundraising by prominent left-wing foundations, Unmasking Antifa is the go-to guide to understand this elusive and dangerous threat. Get your copy of Unmasking Antifa, Five Perspectives on a Growing Threat at Amazon.com.
Welcome back. We're facing challenges domestic as well as foreign, of course, and the challenges are being intensified by what has become of agencies like the Federal Bureau of Investigations, long our premier law enforcement agency and one upon which we have relied for protecting us against domestic enemies in particular. Of late, it has seemingly been mostly about protecting the Biden administration and family, more to the point. In fact, I think that FBI may now stand for Friends of Biden, Inc. Biden, Inc., of course, being the, well, crime syndicate that the Biden family, Joe, his son Hunter, his brother Jim, and assorted other family members have seemingly become over the years in which they've been influence peddling and otherwise aiding and abetting foreign countries and governments, including the Chinese Communist Party's intelligence services. This is scandalous, needless to say, and dangerous in the extreme for our country. The man who understands that perhaps better than just about anybody is our next guest. He is the senior investigator for an absolutely indispensable organization that I'm sure all of you know well, Judicial Watch. His name is Bill Marshall. He brings to his present job a wealth of experience as an investigator, both in government and in the private sector. He is a very accomplished practitioner of the art of Freedom of Information Act requests, used as a forcing function to get access to information that the government doesn't want us to have, and that sometimes turns into some very revealing and impactful legal actions as well. Bill, it's good to have you back, and thank you again for all that you do personally and corporately at Judicial Watch for our country. And we're going to talk about one particular example of that next. Good to have you with us.
Thank you for having me back. Thank you, Frank.
I wanted to get at basically the role that Judicial Watch has been playing in trying to explore and expose what has happened here with the FBI's raid on Mar-a-Lago. Tell us a little bit about your understanding of what was the precipitating action there, and the insights that we've gleaned, such as they are, from your efforts to get access to the affidavit that justified, we're told, the magistrate's authorization of seemingly a general warrant, as opposed to one that is constitutionally permissible, namely very particular ones.
Right. Well, of course, on August 8th, the FBI took an unprecedented action in the history of this country by raiding the home of a former president and potential future presidential candidate by the opposition party president, the incumbent president. I mean, this shocked all of us to our core. There's something that so viscerally touched so many Americans when this happened. And I don't think they fully appreciated on the, Merrick Garland, the attorney general, fully appreciated the effect that this would have. But in essence, what we did was, the pretext, if you will, for this raid was based on the affidavit that was eventually released. The redacted affidavit was violations of the Presidential Records Act, and I believe a provision of the Espionage Act. Now, we filed a lawsuit on August 9th to obtain a copy of the search warrant and all related materials, and that would include the underlying affidavit. And of course, the underlying affidavit, any search warrant is predicated on an affidavit in which the government, the Justice Department, or the FBI makes an argument for probable cause as to why it should be allowed to undertake the highly intrusive action of raiding. Effectively, they deny it. They don't call it a raid, maybe, but that's what it was, to raid someone's private residence. That's a huge step for the government to take. Of course, DOJ opposed our motion. We then submitted on August 12th a reply to their opposition motion, to, citing President Trump's willingness for all of these records to be released himself. That was in his public statement. And eventually, Judge Bruce Reinhart, who had issued the signed off on the warrant, ordered the FBI to release at least a redacted version of their affidavit by Friday, August 25th, which they just did, of course. And
highly redacted version, as it turns
out. Yes. What was even more remarkable is they were almost trolling. The DOJ is almost trolling the American people, because in their cover letter explaining their redactions, they even redacted portions of the cover letter. I mean, it's almost they're mocking. They seem to be mocking the American people. And this, to me, is just so odious. We don't live in the country I grew up in. And I'll tell you, Frank, when I was in the DEA, I worked with the FBI on a fairly regular basis. I have friends there now. I have relatives there. I used to, as you did, I revered them. I grew up watching, the FBI with Ephraim Zimbalist Jr. and all. But I'll tell you, I've been calling for years, as you and I were discussing, for the complete, if not demolition, of the FBI. For a massive reconstitution of it under a new name, with completely apolitical leadership, because we're heading down a very dangerous road here.
Yeah, no question about it. And I did want to commend you for, you know, an article I think you said 4 years ago entitled Sinking the FBI. It seems to have brought this on itself. I think there's no question about it. And it's been shocking that it was under Donald Trump's administration engaged in this, before his administration, and certainly after it, that we've seen a weaponized, politicized organization that, at the very least, at the senior most levels, is abandoning the oath that you took and I took on a number of occasions, I think in probably both of our cases, to support and defend the Constitution of the United States against all enemies, foreign and domestic. They're not doing that. And I think that, you know, unfortunately, it's hard to argue with the idea that at the minimum, there needs to be a thorough house cleaning and reboot, if not take it up from the roots, as I think your colleague Chris Farrell has said on our program and elsewhere. But let me ask you about, and this is a little bit of a hypothetical, but you said Merrick Garland may have underestimated the response. And yet, as you said, in connection with the affidavit and the redacting of it, that maybe they're trolling the American people. I just have to tell you, Bill, that my concern is, this was a provocation. This is something that could only be anticipated to create a backlash from an awful lot of Americans. And that if, as I am, you're suspicious of this administration, its motives, its fidelity to that oath of office, its willingness to abide by the law, to assure that it is equally applied, you got to say to yourself, how can they do what they want to in terms of fundamentally transforming the United States, not just the FBI, but really the whole operation, unless they can justify repression of the large number of Americans who don't want any part of where they want to take this country? And provoking them is one way to bring that about, I'm afraid, is it not?
Yeah, it's really difficult to discern the motivations of the people who are running this government. And we all know it's not Joe Biden, okay? It's self-evident from his appearances, public appearances. The man is non compos mentis, I guess you would say. He is not there. So the question is, who are the people that are pulling the strings here, and what is their motivation? Is it to bring about some kind of a national conflagration of sorts, of, you know, a civil war or something like this? I don't know. I mean, we're certainly everyone, of course, prays nothing like that happens. But the polarization right now is so strong, and they seem so bent on inflaming it, that you have to wonder if this is all by design. And I may be mistaken. It may not have been. They may have expected the backlash. You might be right. I don't know. It's only in the minds and hearts of the people that are running this show that we can discern what's really going on.
But what we can say, I think, without too much fear of correction, is an awful lot of these people seem to have embraced a Marxist strategy of, as I say, Barack Obama called it fundamental transformation. I didn't. That's his term. And whether this is Barack Obama's third term, or whether this is simply one that is being largely run by his former subordinates, where they're taking this country, as you say, Bill, is in a very dangerous direction. And I pray that it's not purposeful. I pray that they're not trying to provoke a conflagration or anything remotely like a civil war, but I fear they may be. And unfortunately, the FBI is not standing against that kind of betrayal of our country. They're standing against the rest of us. We're going to talk more about this domestic terrorism problem being misunderstood and mischaracterized with our next guest, Congressman Pete Hoekstra. But Bill, we have to leave it at that with you. Thank you for your time and the great work you do at Judicial Watch. I know you'll keep it up. Come back to us with more soon. Pete Hoekstra is up next, right after this. is Frank Affney with the Secure Freedom Minute. Whistleblowers have reportedly been confirming to Senators Ron Johnson and Chuck Grassley what many of us have long suspected. The Federal Bureau of Investigations is no longer a premier law enforcement agency whose senior leaders honor their oaths to, quote, support and defend the Constitution of the United States against all enemies, foreign and domestic, unquote. Instead, the acronym FBI these days seems to stand for Friends of Biden, Inc., namely, the crime syndicate that does business as our nation's first family. Thus, we have the spectacle of heavily armed FBI agents rounding up and humiliating the president's political enemies, including raiding the Florida home of his once and likely future rival. Even more odious have been the Bureau's efforts to cover up for or otherwise enable the serial lies, corruption, and betrayals of the big guy, his son, and other relatives and business partners. Enough. This is Frank Affney. And a very special welcome to our next guest. No stranger to this program, that's for sure, but one of our most, I believe, valued colleagues, and certainly one who has served with great distinction in more capacities than most, and done so with great effect for, well, the vital security interests of the United States, notably. He served as a member of Congress for 18 years, including for a time as the chairman of the House Intelligence Committee. He also has been our ambassador to the Netherlands these days, one of his most important capacities, I'd like to think. He is the chairman of the advisory board of our Center for Security Policy. His name is Piet Hoekstra. We've got a lot of different titles for him, but we just call him Your Grace most days. It's always great to have him with us, especially as he is continuing to serve our country in important ways by contributing quite impactfully to the public policy debate about some of the most important foreign and national security policy issues of our time. Congressman, Mr. Ambassador, Your Grace, it's great to have you back. Welcome.
Also, just known as Pete. It's great to be with you, Frank. Thank you.
Thank you, sir. Let me ask you first about a piece that you've written that caught my eye. I think it was at the Gatestone Institute, if I'm not mistaken, where you were talking about the global war on terror, so-called. It is a term that I don't particularly cotton to, but it, as you point out, has certainly become sort of the shorthand for the conflict we found ourselves in, well, first formally with the attacks of 9/11. It continues to this day, though you wouldn't necessarily know it from the lack of serious attention to it. Tell us about both the outset of this war and who the enemy is. Have we properly characterized it, do you think?
Well, I mean, you in that one question, you know, there's a lot of information and stuff that you and I have been talking about for, you know, for close to 20 years. And it's more than 20 years. It's absolutely critical. You know, so, you know, in the last month, the Biden administration, to their credit, took out a couple of top Al-Qaeda ISIS leaders. Great. Okay, let's go. But also in the same vein, we're about at the one-year anniversary of the dramatic and the awful pullout from Afghanistan, both in terms of how it was executed and the aftermath of that, and that we now see the Taliban, one of the leaders that we took out was what? He was living in downtown Kabul. Obviously,
in a guest house of the Haqqanis.
Obviously with the full blessing of the Taliban. So we now again have most likely Al-Qaeda, ISIS, and other terrorist organizations. They now again have their safe haven. The same thing that they had, right after the same thing that they had just leading up to 9/11. And so they're back. They have a safe haven where they can prepare, where they can train, they can outline their strategies and those types of things. So from my perspective, the global war on terror is still very real. There's continuing.
Let me ask you about one way of characterizing what's now there is not just a safe haven for Al-Qaeda and ISIS and other, well, I call them Sharia supremacist groups, but an actual terrorist superstate, as our friend Sam Faddis has been describing it, as a result of, the immense amounts of money and arms that were bequeathed to them by the Biden administration as part of this, as you say, appalling surrender of Afghanistan. Would you agree with that characterization?
I was going to say, Frank, I love the people we hang out with. calling it a terrorist superstate, I would support that. You're right. We left them, we left them a tremendous amount of arms, but we also left them with a tremendous amount of training. We had people there, some of our best forces, our special forces were there training Afghanis in terms of how to, how to kill the bad guys. And some of those folks, I'm sure, are now working back in the terrorist groups. And guess who's now the bad guys? That's us. And you combine that with, their continued desire to attack the West. And what is going on in our southern border? All right. I think the latest number that I saw is 2.5 million people have come in undocumented, illegally, however you want to describe it.
Those are the ones we know about.
Those are the ones. Exactly. I like how you finish my sentences.
The mind meld.
You get there quicker than I do. But you're right. Those are the ones that we know about. And, obviously some of those folks are terrorists affiliated with these terrorist organizations with what? One goal in mind: to attack us in the homeland again. They want a repeat of 9/11.
But Pete, let me just ask you about an even bigger problem in a way that, again, is another offshoot and result of the surrender of Afghanistan. The Biden administration claiming that it was resettling large numbers of our friends and allies in Afghanistan brought in between, I've seen numbers ranging from 70 to 100,000 Afghans. Again, we have no idea who they actually are, but we have reason to believe they're part of the Taliban team, and the preponderance of them are military age and unaccompanied young men. What could possibly go wrong with that? Congressman, I ask you to bear with me. We need to take a short break. When we come back, I want to complete the thought on how serious a problem domestic terrorism may actually be, but not of the kind that the administration is preoccupied with, but, these jihadis that are all over our country now, among other things. We'll also talk with you about another really important piece about China's political mercenaries. We'll get into that and more right after this with Pete Hoekstra. Stand by. We're back, and we're continuing our important conversation with former congressman, former chairman of the House Intelligence Committee, former U.S. Ambassador to the Netherlands. And Pete, we were talking a bit about the problem of the administration having exacerbated the challenges we're facing from this terrorism superstate in Afghanistan by having imported large numbers of men who, it seems, are at least some of them Talibanis into our own country. We hear a lot from the Biden administration about domestic terrorism, but not so much about it coming from that quarter. How serious a problem is the enemy within now? And is the administration missing the bubble on what that enemy is?
Well, I think a couple of things. Number one, we're having worked in that area. There's limited resources. The intelligence community, whether it's the Central Intelligence Agency, the FBI, other law enforcement agencies that have a role in keeping America safe, they've got limited resources. And when you pull them off of the international threat and you move them to, quote unquote, the domestic threat, there's a couple of things. Number one, you take focus off of the real threat. And the second thing is our intelligence community then becomes a threat to Americans. And we've seen this by, the actions of former intelligence officials in terms of the Russiagate, John Brennan, Clapper, and these folks. They are the threat. It's not because they have all this capability and they have all this background, but they're using it for political purposes here in the United States.
It's those guys who are formers who are something of a problem, that's for sure. But I think what you're really getting at is when they were in office, even in the Trump administration, some of them were very problematic. What we're seeing now, witness, speaking of the FBI, what it's been doing to Donald Trump, as we just discussed with Bill Marshall, is an abuse of power for sure, but it's also a diversion of resources from the kinds of places that they need to be applied. And Pete, I wanted to just switch gears because in addition to the as yet incomplete war against, I wouldn't call it terrorism, I would call it against the jihadis or the Sharia supremacists, we have communist China. And you co-chaired a terrific effort, our Team B3 work, which we discussed a little bit before with our friend John Mills, also a member of Team B3. It's entitled, "The CCP, the Chinese Communist Party, is at war with America." Does the Biden administration have a clue that that is the case, let alone is it responding properly to the danger? And if so, why not?
I don't think the Biden administration recognizes that China is at war with the United States. They're not acting or behaving in a way that would give us any confidence that they recognize the threat and they are confronting the threat. And I think as you and the piece that you're the other piece that I wrote for the Washington Times talked about, it's not only the government, but it's our own business leaders. Tom Donahue, the former CEO of the Chamber of Commerce, former Senator Joe Lieberman. They are proxies for the Chinese Communist Party right here in America. They just part of a new group that said, the way to deal with China, let the business leaders take care of it. We'll work out these differences, these points of conflict, and just a little bit more commerce. Well, 20 years ago, 2000, when Tom Donahue was the head of the CEO, he ran ads in my district because I was going to vote against most favored nation status for China.
And the World Trade Organization. Yeah.
Yeah. And they were advocating and they were saying, hey, let's engage with China and let's give them most favored nation status. And as we engage with China, they will become more like us. They will become less repressive to their own people. They will open up their markets to our products. They will allow U.S. companies to go in and establish a footprint and those types of things. And after 20 years, Tom Donahue is still sounding the same call, siren call.
Hey. Song.
And it's like, Tom, take a look at what's happened over the last 20 years. China has become more repressive. our companies go in there, but when they go in there, they steal our technology. As a matter of fact, China goes into our universities. They go into our businesses here and try to steal our technology. It is an evil
or simply take down our industrial base.
They've done a pretty good job. It's why Donald Trump won in 2016. The workers in Michigan who lost their jobs to China, they're saying, wait a minute, we need someone to stand up for us and stand up against China in this regime.
Your article in the Washington Times really basically talks about political mercenaries who are coming out of, as you say, the business community, especially the financial sector. The Larry Finks at BlackRock and Steve Schwarzman at Blackstone are people who have made fortunes themselves using our money, American, pensioners and the like, to enrich the Chinese communists and in turn get rich themselves. I'm not so sure this has been great for the average investor, but it's been horrific in terms of the underwriting of the Chinese Communist Party threat, including, as we talk about in this book, the biological warfare attack that the Chinese have perpetrated here.
The United States, our citizens, through the monies that we've got invested, that these people have taken and invested in China, we're nationals. We believe in, we want a great America. These business leaders, they're internationals. They're globalists. They don't care where they make their money. And if they can make their money in China, they will take our money that they direct the investments for, even our thrift savings plan for the federal government, and they will invest it in China so that they can get a return. They'll get a short-term return, but they will weaken and are weakening and destroying America.
That's the point. Pete Hoekstra, we have to leave it at that. Thank you, my friend. Come back to us again with updates on all of this, if you will, very soon. We will look forward to a further talk with the rest of you, I hope, again tomorrow. Same time, same station. Until then, this is Frank Gaffney. Thanks for watching.